April 1969. Al's and my first Sunday at the Fox Valley Unitarian Universalist Fellowship in the long gone YMCA building on North Spencer Street. A young couple with a 15-month-old son, and we were there because Kimberly Clark had transferred Al and me and our baby and our St. Bernard from New Milford, Connecticut to the Fox Valley, where we'd bought a house in Appleton on our advance trip just a few weeks earlier. Both Al and I grew up in Rockford, Illinois. Both our families joined the Church of the Christian Union, Unitarian, in Rockford. We were married in that church in 1963. And way led on to way, the way that it did back then. And there we were, a young couple, constructing our family life, hoping to find a religious home. That first evening, that first Sunday, must have been wonderful because we didn't know then that our bio data for Appleton would eventually list Fox Valley Unitarian Universalist Fellowship, 1969 to 1985. That first Sunday had another building block in my life. In the coffee hour that morning at church, Marge Koepke came up to me and she introduced herself and asked me if I were a member of the League of Women Voters. I said, no. And she said, well, you should join. You look just like you should belong to the League of Women Voters. So I took baby steps in the League of Women Voters, too, and eventually served as president for two terms. I do remember a new member, as a new member in the League of Women Voters, really wondering why such an educated group of nice women would be so interested in solid waste disposal. But I learned. And what I learned in the fellowship and what I learned in the League of Women Voters, that you, if you show up and do a small job well, you get promoted a lot. And that was a very useful thing to learn in my mid-20s. When we first came to the Fox Valley Unitarian Universalist Fellowship, the official membership was about 20 to 25 adults. Al and I were part of the growth and change. We had many wise elders and many families with young children. At different times, I was chair of religious education program chair and president. I do think that one of the best things I ever did was to, each time we had a baby, a religious education, I would take the baby to the class and bathe the baby when they were about 3 or 4 months old. And I've always thought that was my pinnacle idea. Now, all of us worked hard, as you do, on Sunday services back then that were held September through June. And then we had summer events like picnics and evening summer salons and discussion groups in our homes. But there was music almost every Sunday. And we had a book group that read works written by African Americans. We enjoyed being together. We worked well together. We did some social justice work, and several of us had had experience with Unitarian or Universalist congregations. And I remember how pleased we were to have a real Unitarian Universalist minister come a couple times a year. I didn't know it then, but in looking back, I'm not surprised that my life led me into the Unitarian Universalist ministry. In 1991, there were two milestones for me, graduating from Perkins with my Master's of Divinity and being ordained by the First Unitarian Church of Dallas. I have loved the ministry and being a minister. The ministry is a wonderful career to continue after formal retirement because I can do all the parts that I love, preaching, teaching, interfaith work, and special projects like our beautiful memorial garden in Door County. And I can say no to budgets, bylaws, and meetings. The this morning, it gives me great pleasure to be here with you and your congregation that does the same things that we did. But you do it on steroids. It sort of feels like a family reunion with a second cousins twice removed, and I see the resemblance to your cousins, aunts, and uncles that I knew. Your building is spectacular. Reverend Christina is an energetic powerhouse. The list of activities in your newsletter is astonishing, and your commitment to make the world a better place, it radiates. Now I want to tell you about the time I encountered a Buddha, the Buddha, perhaps. That story really begins in a conversation that Al and I had with Jeannie Linden in the stairwell of the Linden Center in Ellison Bay in Door County. We were reminiscing about the excellent photography class that Al and I had taken at the Linden Center in China's Yunnan province in 2013. And Jeannie mentioned that she and Brian had been thinking for several years about designing a trip with a focus on spirituality. And then she said, but the right leader hasn't come along. The right leader hasn't come along. Would you be interested? I was. Al was sort of appalled. He was surprised that I decided. And Jeannie and Brian designed The Spirit of Travel, a trip in 2015. There were 9 or 10 people enrolled. We came, we went, we came, glad to be home. And something lingered. But on this morning, I want to talk about my experience from the perspective of the religious imagination. More specifically, my perspective. I don't think that more than a couple people on our trip were in the huge room in the acres vast Buddhist monastery when I had an experience which continues to echo in my life. Imagine my surprise and delight when I had 2 Buddha encounters at 10,700 feet in China. They sort of kept on happening. But first, I want to remind you how we, Unitarian Universalists, are especially opened to and wired to appreciate the religious imagination. For individuals keep trying in all times and places, trying to understand the world and their place in it. And so do the stories and rituals evolve in all times and places. Our living tradition, as you know, draws from many sources. Embedded in our way of being religious is an openness and trying to understand that diversity of religious experience of all those other people with whom we share the world. It doesn't mean that we will conclude that any particular way of being religious is a good way if it doesn't lead to more justice, equity, and love. Now on that 13-day long Spirit of Travel, it was an invitation to be a cultural tourist with our eyes and hearts wide open to the incredible diversity of religious and ethnic diversity, with customs and religious images and spiritual traditions that are a whole lot different from what we see and know and understand. As we know, staying present in the midst of not knowing is a challenge. On one occasion, the local Bai people had a musical concert for us, and it included dancers. And after they had finished their performance, we had arranged this beforehand, but our tour group asked them to linger, and we sang to them hymn number 159, This Is My Song. They weren't understanding the words, but these will be familiar to you. This is my song, O God of all the nations, a song of peace for lands afar and mine. This is my home, the country where my heart is. Here are my hopes, my dreams, my holy shrine. But other hearts in other lands are beating with hopes and dreams as true and high as mine. My country's skies are bluer than the ocean, and sunlight beams on clover leaf and pine. But other lands have sunlight too, and clover, and skies are everywhere as blue as mine. Oh, hear my song, thou God of all the nations, a song of peace for their land and for mine. Their delight, a flurry of smile, and everybody trying to photograph everybody else. It was a spontaneous life highlight moment, a very happy memory. Jeannie and Brian Linden had planned for us an incredible quantity and quality of experiences. The Linden Center itself is the most beautiful inn that Al and I have ever spent time in. Their courtyards, meals that had beautiful food that were interesting and nourishing, and we ate with chopsticks, intimate and public spaces, background lectures on Buddhism and Taoism. I taught my toward a personal creed class, the second session of which included the most personally profound group discussion in my career in ministry. The Linden's first ever music in residence was there. There was a man who was on a leg of a 4-year around the world solo bike journey collecting stories about climate change. And we completed classes. There was exercises on the upper deck, and where I could see workers walking in single file to the rice fields that abutted the Linden Center. Dinner in with a Muslim family was followed by strolling to the Muslim mosque, where we stood and watched men gather outside the mosque in evening dusk, Brian Linden schmoozing with them until the call to prayer was sounded by the trumpet. We saw each man remove his shoes before entering the mosque. China allows men to pray, gather for prayers 5 times a day, but will not allow the call to prayer to be amplified on loudspeakers. But through the open door, we stood and watched the men at prayer, something I never would have imagined I would see from a distance of 30 or 40 feet away. A highlight was a local Buddhist temple festival, and it was an experience that we at first were so overwhelmed that we backed away when they invited us to participate with a sense of sort of alarm, but just step by step. We were invited to participate in the celebration of an important traveling Benzu statue that had come from Shijo the day before and needed to be delivered to the next Beiju temple with great processional fanfare. It was a long box on top of long sticks, and the men carried it, and it was carried always from village to village to village. It was a sacred statue, and they shared it, and so that they carried it from place to place. And we became part of that fanfare, starting with slurping noodles in not very clean dishes with only slightly dipped chopsticks. All of us sitting on very low tables and very low stools. And then someone offered me and others a banner to carry in the procession, and our banner carrying section immediately gathered in front of the horns and part that marched around Shijo on small winding streets. We marched briskly and ceremoniously through those narrow streets. At intersection, hundreds and hundreds of firecrackers exploded, and in front of shops, small piles of evergreen smoldered and burned. The air was thick with incense and smoke, obscuring our vision, filling our eyes and nostrils. I experienced much more than I understood. It was often more interesting and exotic than spiritually meaningful, but there always was the "you're not in Kansas anymore" feeling. I regret not knowing more about who or what or why, but you go and you stay there and you are present, because we know that not knowing is a frequent companion in our lives. It was kind of cultural tourism at its best. All of this happened in the 7 nights we were based at the Linden Center before we traveled many miles in interesting places on the way to Shangri-La. It was one of the most important Buddhist temples in the world. It's located at 11,900 feet altitude, and that has issues of its own, located along an important trading site between Tibet and Southeast Asia. It was built by the 5th Dalai Lama in 1679. It belonged to the Yellow Hat sect of the Gelugpa order of Tibetan Buddhism. Extensively damaged in the Cultural Revolution, it was rebuilt in 1983, and at its peak it contained accommodation for 2,000 monks, but currently accommodated about 700 monks in 200 associated houses. During the trip, my core energy had flagged unexpectedly, and hiking distances became increasingly painful after tripping on a rocky stairs. While I was physically and emotionally supported by Al and many individuals on the group, I felt the inadequacy of not making the distance, of grimacing when I would have preferred to have been schmoozing, lagging when I expected myself to be available to do something leaderly whenever it was needed. I did not want to give my body and mind more attention than it deserves, but the high altitude and significant pains were significant parts of the journey for me, and hard to incorporate because I had arrived much fitter than I became later in the trip. And that is the segue to what would happen within one of the temples we walked on the last full day of the Spirit of Travel. I climbed hundreds and hundreds of granite steps without railings. Maybe it was thousands and thousands of steps. We saw dozens or hundreds and hundreds of Buddha statues, many of which were 2 or 3 stories high. The main hall interior space for each temple was cavernous and chilled, and we occasionally glimpsed a few crimson-robed monks, but mostly we saw the other tourists. I was beyond exhausted and hurt everywhere as we continued. Finally, I glimpsed the only chair I had seen in 3 hours, and I aimed myself for it. There it was. It was a huge, handsome brown Barca lounger recliner shoved in the back left corner of this temple's cavernous main hall. The chair butted up against two large gongs resting on the floor. Smile. Suddenly, a crimson-robed man rushed toward me from about 40 feet away, waving his arms, shouting angrily, his face scrunched up edge to edge in a terrifying grimace. And I got up and left. I didn't scurry. I just resumed my previous trudge. I noticed how calm I felt and how much I felt I had done nothing wrong to have a furious monk charge me. Eventually, we all walked down hundreds, was it thousands, of steps and made our way back to the bus that would take us back to our inn, our group being interested and sympathetic. I pondered the experience in the hours and days to come. It interested me. I imagined a small Zen story about a monk spying an old, poor, exhausted, enfeebled woman collapsing in a chair in the holy space, and I wondered about compassion and monks' job descriptions. About monks' bad days and angry impulses. And I suddenly found myself imagining the monk thinking about me and the harm that I hadn't done. And then I wondered what would have happened if, when I saw him waving his arms, shouting angrily, his face scrunched up edge to edge in a terrifying grimace rushing toward me, if I had stood up slowly and smiled at him and dipped my head respectfully to my host who had just appeared. What would have happened if I had stood up and started shouting at the interruption of my meditation on suffering? What would have happened if I had fallen to my knees and begged mercy? What would have happened if my quiet tears coursed down my cheek? But most of all, I pondered whether he, after our encounter, thought about it, whether he thought about it again. Did he tell his brother monks about the encounter? Has he ever regretted not recognizing a moment in which he had a wide choice of options for his response, and he had chosen one option over another? My religious imagination played with the idea that he and I were destined to meet, not just once, but over and over and over and over until we worked it out in our imagination, different scenarios. And then my religious imagination suddenly understood that this is the message of that wonderful movie, Groundhog Day. You've got to get it right before you can move into the future. And I have enjoyed thinking imaginatively, a little Buddhistly. I remember the time, just a little after this, when one of the women in our group came up to me when I was struggling on a long hike. She put one hand on each of my shoulders, and she said, "Cynthia, someone has to be last." It had been a Buddhist encounter to teach me what I haven't learned yet, or maybe I just forgot it for a while. I have two readings I want to end that part with. After I came back home, I found this reading when I wasn't even looking for it. Bells ring, drums resound. When a bell is struck, it rings. When a drum is beaten, it resounds. This is because they are solid outside and empty within. It is because they have nothing inside that they are able to ring and resound. What I realized, I observe this as the Tao of true emptiness and ineffable existence. True emptiness is like the inner openness of a bell or a drum. It is like the sounding of a bell or a drum when struck. If people can keep this true emptiness as their essence and utilize this ineffable existence of their function, serene yet responsive, ever responsive yet serene, tranquil, unstirring yet sensitive and effective, lively, active, refining everything in the great furnace of creation. When the dirt is gone, the mirror is clear. Yin and yang, creation, merge with the eternity of space. And my last part of this is that I wrote a prayer poem for a weekend retreat for the board of directors of the First Unitarian Church of Dallas in 1993, and along the way it became a touchstone of my life. Knowing, doing, being, three strands to braid together in the whole to make a life. Knowing, we're so good at knowing, quick-witted, intelligence, well-educated, bright, perceptive, we can trust our minds to tell us important truths. Knowing, doing, We're good doers. We have good judgment, many skills, a willing heart, busy hands. We understand bureaucracies and can wend our way through red tape. We want to fix things because our hearts are good and because we're pretty good at it. Doing. Being. Just being. Here. Now. Enough. Nothing other than just what is. Nothing demanded, nothing sought, nothing claimed. Sustained as part of a oneness that is me and not me. Breathe. Smile. Being. I look at the braid of my week, brilliant strands of knowing, sturdy strands of doing, gossamer strands of being, just barely holding the pattern of left over right, right over left over right, right over left. The braid of my life grows a little lopsided as I try to will being into the braid because I know it needs to be there. But I've got a little being deficit this week, so I think I'll try to hide behind these impressive strands of knowing and doing. Knowing, doing, being. Knowing, doing, being. Three strands to be braided together into a whole to make our life. Mystery abounds.